You're listening to On Subrogation, the litigation podcast about how to recover your damages from the people who caused them. We are your hosts. I'm Rebecca Wright.
And I'm Steve Alsop, and we are both experienced civil litigators and partners at Rathbone Group.
If you have questions or comments during our podcast, please email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or you can visit us at our website, rathbonegroup.com.
Steve, have you ever had a discovery set that requested the entire claim file from the client?
Several times.
I have as well. So I guess the next question is, have you ever sent it?
Never once.
Me neither, because in general, we consider the claim files, the client's claim file itself, to be privileged. It's protected from discovery, or at least that's our position on it. Mm-hmm. And so today we are going to talk about why that is and what those protections actually cover, because certainly certain aspects of the claim file will often have to be turned over in the course of discovery during litigation. Mm-hmm. But the entire claim file itself, you generally have a pretty good argument for not turning that over.
I would agree.
So let's talk about privilege. The claim file itself is typically covered by what we call the work product privilege. When we're talking about the work product doctrine, what we are talking about is documents and tangible things that are prepared in anticipation of litigation. And they have to be prepared by the party or its representative, and that does include attorneys and consultants and agents and indemnitors. So if the court finds that these parts of the claim file, their claim file as a whole, are prepared in anticipation of litigation, then they can protect it under the work product doctrine, and that then shifts the burden to the party who's requesting the documentation to prove that they have a substantial need for the materials to prepare their case and that they don't have another way without undue hardship to obtain those documents or a substantial equivalent.
Specifically, this is always listed as a lawyer's research, analysis of legal theories, mental impressions, notes, and memoranda of witness statements. And these are the sorts of things that are always given as an example of what work product doctrine protects.
Absolutely. It was originally created to protect lawyers who were developing their case, who are working through the case, making notes on things. Those notes and things are absolutely protected, but it has since been expanded to cover other things created by the party, him or herself or itself and its representatives in anticipation of litigation. So what we've seen, I think, in the case law is that the work product privilege and whether it covers the claim file really depends on the point in time at which the documents were created. And it's about whether litigation was anticipated at that time.
So that's the central inquiry, is whether or not the documents in the files were generated in anticipation of litigation or if they were generated for some other reason.
So certainly once the client has made a decision that the claim will be subrogated, then you can argue protection because the subrogation decision is a litigation decision, anticipation of litigation. But similarly, it has also been argued that before that time, there's an anticipation of litigation because of the fact that there has been some sort of loss or incident. And so there might be a defense that's required for the insurer to provide to the insured under the terms of the policy.
So in defense circumstances, the work product doctrine should attach from the moment the insurer is notified of the claim, even if it hasn't gone into litigation. So if there's a claim against me personally, the moment that I notify my insurer that there's this claim out there, work product should attach. And any of the research or mental impressions notes, things like that that I mentioned, should be protected from being exposed to the other side.
And we have to make a distinction here between documents and things that are prepared in anticipation of litigation as opposed to in the regular course of business. That is the distinction that is made by the courts when talking about privilege. And of course, the problem is when we're talking about insurance companies, their regular course of business, the adjustment of claims and things, can look an awful lot like the anticipation of litigation.
Absolutely.
And certainly our argument is that that's because it is in the anticipation of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right, Steve, that what kind of litigation is going to make a difference. So, for example, if a party is requesting the claim file from an insurer and the insurer is not a party to the action, then generally the court is going to protect that claim file because they're going to find that the claim file was created in anticipation of the litigation, that it was created by the party, by the insurer itself, and the party that's requesting that claim file is going to have a difficult time showing a substantial need for that information because of the fact that the insurer is ancillary to the action.
So what about claim files for first party claims? Generally, these are not necessarily prepared in anticipation of litigation, and the courts are going to judge these on a case-by-case basis. In these circumstances, the only litigation anticipated would be a potential bad faith claim between the insurer and the insured. So the courts are going to look at those and say, you know, at what point should this start to be privileged and what point is it not? At what point is it anticipated that litigation is going to result from this claim?
Well, and when we talk about bad faith claims and deck actions, we can also get into the issue of what if the insurer had provided counsel to defend the insured and then the insured files some sort of claim for bad faith or a deck action against the insurer. That's when we get into what is known as a tripartite relationship, where the courts have found that the lawyer in that situation owes a contractual obligation to the carrier, but a fiduciary duty to the insured, and that the claim file is treated as belonging to both parties. And because of that, and because typically in that situation, it's the insured who is going to be requesting the claim file, that claim file is not going to be privileged because essentially the insured is one of the ones who owns that privilege.
Do you want to talk about fiduciary duty really fast?
Sure.
Generally, one of the other duties that an insurer has to its insured is to protect the insured where the insurer is in possession of confidential or other privileged information of the insured. So just anything that's sensitive to the policyholder, your insurance company shouldn't be turning that over to other folks. There should be some sort of separation between third parties and that confidential information. And in a lot of cases where that information actually has to be turned over, it can be turned over under seal for attorney's eyes only or otherwise marked confidential and doesn't leave the context of the litigation that you're in.
So what we've been talking in sort of broad terms about the claim file, but it should be noted that if somebody requests the claim file in their discovery requests, that is probably an improper request. What they need to do is request individual documentation in the claim file because you really can't make a blanket statement about the relevance of each and every document in that claims file, about the protectedness of that claim file and what everything has to do with your case. But by extension, it's also difficult to argue that the claim file as a whole is protected either.
Right, because if you think about it this way, if everything you put in the claim file became protected, you would never disclose anything because everything that we have, especially in the subrogation context, is going in that claim file. The estimates for damages, repairs, everything that has to do with the investigation by other parties, like the expert reports, police reports, things like that, that's all a part of the claim file, and frankly, most of that stuff you actually want to turn over because it proves your case and maybe can help resolve it. And you turn over the estimates to show that the damages are what you say they are. You turn over the police report to show who was at fault for an automobile accident. So not everything in the claim file do you even want to be protected.
Well, and individually speaking, things like the police report won't be privileged ever because of the fact that they were not created by the insurance company or by a party working on its behalf. Mm-hmm. And because they were not privileged to start with. They weren't, you know, they're part of, in some areas, the public record, and in other areas, they're available to certain people, but they're certainly available to, say, the defendant in a subrogation action.
So if you have a fire report, it will depend on if it were an independent investigator or if it were, say, the local municipality doing a fire report.
That is correct. When it comes to things like your expert reports, you don't necessarily have to disclose those until such time as you determine that you are going to identify that expert to testify or retain that expert to actually testify at the trial or in the litigation.
So it's kind of a matter of personal style. I tend to, if I have a good expert report, to disclose it as early as possible. If there's no flaws with it, you can generally get the case resolved faster if they see that you have a good case.
Well, and I think that's true about a lot of these aspects of the claim file as well. We talk about things like a insured statement. And we're going to talk in a minute about why the insured statement in and of itself is typically privileged and you don't have to produce it. But if I have a statement from the insured that is really great, it shows that my insured is a solid witness and contains really useful information that proves liability against the other side, then I'll probably disclose that because it will lead to an earlier settlement in the case rather than trying to hold that close to the vest and requiring that the opposing party take a deposition or something like that.
So since we're talking about the insured statement or statements in general, let's back up and talk about attorney-client privilege as it applies to things in the claim file, because that is where protection for those statements comes in.
Right. So typically when we argue that the insured's statement to the client, to the insurance company, is protected, we are arguing that it is protected under an attorney-client privilege. And it's a funny sort of argument because, as you imagine, typically attorney-client privilege covers those statements between an attorney and a client. And in these situations, there may not be an attorney involved yet. So the general definition or the general requirements for attorney-client privilege are that there's a relation of an attorney and client which existed at the time of the communication, that the communication was made in confidence, so you can't have anybody else in the room. The communication relates to a matter about which the attorney is being professionally consulted, and it was made in the course of giving or seeking legal advice for a proper purpose. Although litigation itself does not need to be contemplated, it does need to have to do with legal advice as a whole, and that the client has not waived the privilege.
And the public policy there is to encourage full and frank communication between attorneys and their clients. The thinking is that this promotes broader public interests and the administration of justice. So if clients were in a position where their communications with their attorneys could be disclosed later on, they would always have an incentive to lie or mislead or otherwise not disclose every relevant fact. And the result would be detrimental to all litigation and criminal justice as well, for that matter, because you would never know, the attorney would never know if you're on the same page as your insured or your client, rather, and you would never know basically what would happen until everything came out at trial.
Exactly. But then how do we relate this privilege to a conversation between the insured and the insurance agent, or the claims adjuster, rather? How is it possible that this attorney-client privilege can be satisfied with those statements? Well, many courts have found that communications made by insureds to non-lawyer representatives of the insurer may be protected because the communications, at least in some situations, are made for the dominant purpose of transmission to an attorney assigned to defend the claim. So the courts, in some ways, are sort of conflating the attorney-client privilege with the work product doctrine because they're getting back to an anticipation of litigation style argument here, but it seems to hold as far as protecting the statements. So in other words, because the insured statement may become central to the defense of a claim with regard to the loss, then that statement is protected by attorney-client privilege, and it is treated as if it were a statement between an attorney and a client.
The idea is that any communications between the insured and the insurer will necessarily be forwarded on to counsel. So therefore, they have to be protected by attorney-client privilege. Otherwise, the same pitfalls apply. The insured would have an incentive to lie or withhold things, and that's something you don't want in the administration of these claims.
This isn't a bulletproof argument. There is actually a very interesting case about this in New York from 1996. It's actually a criminal matter where the defendant was trying to protect a statement that he had given to his own insurance company. And the court found that the statement, which was taken 1 week after the loss occurred, was not protected by attorney-client privilege because there was no attorney-client relationship established or even contemplated at the time of the statement. And the statement was taken in the course of the insurer's business of adjusting the claim, not at the request of an attorney. What's interesting in this New York case is that the court did find that work product applied. The work product doctrine protected this statement from the insured because litigation could have been anticipated at the time that the statement was taken, exactly what we were talking about. But the court also found that the opposing party demonstrated a substantial need and inability to obtain the substantial equivalent. specifically pointing out that the opposing party had conducted a deposition of the insured and it had left open several questions of material fact. So you can see how these two privileges get conflated from case to case to result in different things. In this particular New York case, then, because of the fact that the opposing party was able to meet its burden of substantial need and inability to obtain a substantial equivalent, the court did find that the statement to the insurance company had to be disclosed.
Now, a court in Texas has actually reasoned that it's a little different than saying that the communications will necessarily be forwarded on to counsel. The courts in Texas, this is in In re Arden, held that an insured's witness statement taken by an adjuster could be withheld from disclosure because the adjuster was acting as the insured's representative for purposes of communicating with the retained defense counsel. So it's just a hair off from the other argument, but it is different. Either way, the insured statement is protected.
California has found the same thing, as has New Jersey, Wisconsin, Alaska, Hawaii, Illinois, and even Ohio. We see this all over the place, this protection of the insured's statements. And certainly I feel like we could help the court to see that that New York case is somehow different from most of the other cases, especially because of the fact that they were dealing with a criminal action as opposed to, say, a subrogation claim. So we've talked about the general protection of the claim file and the specific protections that apply to the insured statements. Are there any other portions of the claim file that end up being protected for specific reasons?
What about the policy itself, the very fact that there is a policy or the paper copy of the policy that underlies the action?
That's so interesting because in most situations, we would say, well, of course we have to turn that over, and we would turn it over without questions, except one, right?
Except for one, and it always hasn't been this way. To me, it's just not practical to not disclose insurance information. And in fact, Federal Rule 26 requires the disclosure and production of all your insurance policies, which may provide coverage for a judgment. But if you think about the purpose of discovery is to disclose information that is relevant to either damages or liability, especially before there has been a judgment in a case, if you're looking at a pre-judgment discovery, whether or not there is an ability to repay or whether or not there is an insurance policy that may pay all or part of a potential judgment down the road, it really isn't relevant to liability and it's not relevant to the damages. All it does is make sure that the folks in the litigation will have some way to recover at the end. Nearly all states have amended their rules of civil procedure to require that insurance policies that may satisfy a judgment be disclosed and produced. And there is one that does not, and it's Tennessee. Tennessee does not require disclosure of policies, and the Tennessee Supreme Court has held that a plaintiff may not discover insurance policies that may be used to satisfy a judgment, and specifically said this information is not relevant to liability, which is technically true.
It
does make it hard to litigate, though, when you never know if at the end of the line there's going to be any way to recover.
So in general, there are certainly arguments to be made to protect the client's claim file, to protect the contents of the client's claim file. Certainly the statements, the recorded statements of the insured in the adjustment of the claim, as well as, if you're in Tennessee, the policy itself and the policy limits. I think that the important thing to remember here is that if you are the one fighting for the disclosure of someone else's claim file, you may be setting bad precedent for the next time someone wants you to disclose yours. So we always want to tread lightly when we're starting to make these arguments here. In general, there are lots of other ways that you can get to the information that is contained in those files, and much of it, which is considered privileged, may not even be relevant to your subrogation action.
That's true.
Do you have anything else on the privilege or the protections of the client's claim files?
I think we hit all the main points. And this is obviously a bird's eye view of all of the ins and outs of privilege and work product as it applies to a claim file. There are countless cases on this issue, and jurisdictions treat this area of law differently. But in general, work product and attorney-client privileges are the way to go if you're trying to protect the claim file or the statements therein.
Well, we want to thank you for listening to On Subrogation today. Again, if you have any questions about what we talked about today or comments, feel free to contact us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
And again, visit our website, www.rathbonegroup.com.
Until next time, I'm Rebecca Wright.
Stephen Elsa.
Over and out.
Goodbye.